Hello and welcome to the Crossbox Podcast. It is September 28th of 2017, and yet again we managed to push our middle of the month episode to the end of the month. So I think we may as well just say it's going to be an roughly end of the month thing now. I mean, going by our pattern.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Well, now we've gotten kind of behind the eight ball on this. You know, we finish an episode, we have that nice episode finished glow, and then
we get busy.
Well, then we get busy, and it's only like 2 weeks I have to record the next one. We can't think of topics in 2 weeks. That's impossible. Yep. And so we end up pushing it back until once again we're at the end of the month, which brings us to today.
Yep. Now, if you just shut up, people would think it was intentional or something.
I'm all about being open and honest with these things.
I'm not, but that's why you're part of... That's one of the reasons why you're part of this partnership.
Yes. Well, somebody has to be.
Exactly.
Well, I guess let's get diving in.
No, let's be positive for once.
Well, I suppose we're positive for a little bit every episode.
Yeah.
But I'm especially positive about this one. So, it was actually thanks to John that I found out about this wonderful piece of military hardware. I would call it something Bungo Pete would be proud of.
Oh, yes.
And it is not, in fact, one of Japan's actual destroyers. It is one of Japan's mine countermeasures support ships. Which is to say, a 5,800-ton, 22-knot minesweeper tender.
Sounds like a frigate to me.
It does sound like a frigate. And you know, if you look aft, it's got this giant helicopter deck, which you know they say is for a helicopter to help sweep and or lay mines, but it's you know sized perfectly for, say, one or two anti-submarine helicopters.
Yep.
It's got this enormous foredeck, which has room for a gun. One of the two of the class has it, and... It may as well have, like, kanji printed around a square for the forward saying, install VLS here.
Yeah. Yeah, 5,800 tons is quite large and capacious.
Yeah. Now, the class is the Uraga class. I believe the first one is, you know, named Uraga, like you'd expect.
Correct.
But the second one is called Bungo, which is pretty on the nose.
Which is so perfect.
If you recall Run Silent, Run Deep, you will remember Bungo Pete, the fictional Japanese destroyer captain and enemy. Who did skipper a real Japanese destroyer, but as I understand, was not a historical figure himself. Still, he was like basically the boogeyman of American submarine captains in that fictional world, and it's something that kind of entered the submariner's lexicon.
Yeah, this guy was the Darth Vader of the Sea of Japan.
Exactly, and it's basically like naming a helicopter carrying destroyer Kaga. Oh.
Wait.
They did that already.
Right? Yeah, it's a really big helicopter carrying destroyer, too.
I suppose it's maybe mixing a little bit of news into my positivity segment.
That's okay.
But not long ago, the Prime Minister of Japan called a snap election because his approval ratings have been skyrocketing based on his good handling of North Korea crises and so on. And his platform includes... basically the depacifization of Japan, taking the bits of their constitution that say they can't have an offensive military out, and presumably that would also involve fitting the helicopter-carrying destroyer Kaga with a flight deck that can take, you know, F-35 heat, and perhaps a hangar that can store AMRAAMs.
Right.
And suddenly there's a new carrier power in the
China Sea. Yeah, they also have those FX-2 Mitsubishi stealth fighters.
Yeah.
Which I'm so tempted to refer to as the Zero... Mark II. But,
well, they don't have a carrier-capable variant that we know of. So.
Right, that we know of.
Yeah. Yet. They're also not their conventional takeoff and landing, right?
Yeah.
Well, it'd be a little bit harder to fit off of something. Like you'd have to fit a ski jump or something to
right.
Kaga. Which, granted, I'm sure there's one of those like in a warehouse somewhere in Japan.
Yeah. You could also probably get it to Cattlebar if you designed it right. But yeah. I don't know what the structural weight is because I don't work for Mitsubishi.
Yeah. But, I mean, they have a long history of this sort of thing. They know what they're doing.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, how about you?
Well, because your World War II references are entirely too subtle, I am going to be very positive about, in general, collector-grade publications. A wonderful firearms history book publishing company out of, the suburbs of Buffalo, New York, of all places. And more specifically, their newly revised Sturmgewehr book. Which is, of course, about the wonderful STG-44, MP-44. It has, like, about a dozen other names. But the first ever actual properly fielded assault rifle that was deployed in large numbers, that people actually made doctrine for, that was generally well-received. There's a lot of prototypes people say are the first assault rifle, and this is the first, you know, actual one that you would encounter
I think
or capture.
That's more than fair.
Right. I mean, you know, the Russians have some that they captured. The Americans have some that they captured. The British have some that they captured. You know, this is an actual thing that was deployed.
It is really amazing how much of the post-war military environment was shaped by what the Germans did in 1944.
Well, they were pretty brilliant. And so the soapbox will have a bunch of content where we're going to look at some of the stuff that the Germans thought about the STG-44 and kind of, you know, give it the once over with, you know, another 70 odd years of thinking, because we're still pretty much, you know, we're using very similar stuff, you know, and I mean, the AK-47 is almost identical to an STG-44. And even, you know, something like the M16, the cartridge is a little different, but the principles, the basic design, the fundamental operating procedures are really similar. So we're going to look at what the Germans thought and kind of their operating environment and then see, you know, what we think of that. So there's two or three stuff coming in the pipeline. The book is actually really good about giving wonderful historical background, all of that wonderful Nazi politics, because despite being a dictatorship, they had all kinds of wonderful backstabbiness to make Game of Thrones fans jealous. And then they also talk about, you know, planned and actual employment of the weapon. And planning is pretty interesting. Granted, the Germans never actually got around to, you know, equipping units by the book, but it's still really interesting to see what they planned and then think about, you know, hey, does this make sense really ever?
Yeah.
Does this still work, right? You know, so you can see with the Marines and the M27 IAR, which is really just a beefed up M16 with a couple different parts that's been made in Germany, they're really focusing on kind of something that looks an awful lot like the Sturm battalions.
Yeah.
So we're going to see, right, kind of that use of the... And it's also, now it's one part Sturm battalion, maybe three part Sturm battalion, and a couple parts, you know, early classic World War II Marine organization with the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle. So there's definitely Marine heritage in here too. You know, not saying there isn't. But we're, you know, they've definitely coming full circle on a lot of stuff. And, you know, nothing's new under the sun. So let's see what the Germans thought, what their arguments were for and against, how they ended up, and then how does that look today? Because, I mean, let's be honest here, uncomfortable truth, we've got a lot of the same problems they did in terms of, you know, manning problems. You know, they had it because they were a conscript army where a lot of the conscripts were dead. And, you know, eventually you keep calling for people and you run out of people.
Or in the gulags.
Right. And we have a professional army, which by definition is smaller. So there's
always light on people.
Yep. People is always a problem. And there's all these like high tech specialist crap you have to be doing. So, you know, the grunts with the rifles that you need to actually storm positions and take things, you get kind of light on those. So we'll see, but it should be really cool. There's a couple really interesting little things we'll be doing with that. So collector grade publications in general, if there's a firearm you like, they probably have a book about it, or they may have written a book about it back in the day. There's stuff that is in production now, that is being published now, is a little expensive, but reasonable for what you get, considering, you know, that they are really well-researched books with great pictures. And it's a small, you know, market, small demand.
Yeah.
They're out of print books. Get up there like some of Honeycutt's books. They are really expensive. So those are the kind of things where you want to watch for deals if you have one that interests you. But they've got a ton of really good stuff on just about everything that, you know, gun history enthusiasts want in terms of major designs. So we'll have a link in the description to Collector Grade Publications website where we can try to spend some of your money.
You should talk for a bit while I write that down.
All right. Keep going. But yeah, they've got stuff, and they also do like some multi-part books. They've got a two-part book on the AR-15, M16 in U.S. service. They've got a four-part book on the Browning machine gun, another like three-part book on the M1 carbine.
All kinds of good stuff.
Oh yeah. Again, in terms of big major guns or even like minor guns of some repute, like they have a book on the frickin' SA-80, that piece of garbage. There's a book on it.
Speaking of, that brings us to the news. Yeah. All right. Well, I believe you're up first.
So yeah. And that's actually a nice segue. Yeah. With garbage weapons.
I was, that's what I was thinking. I was on the ball for once. I even have the timer up now already.
Wow. Yeah. We're prepared.
This is unusual. Don't get used to it.
Yep.
So I guess I'll count you down.
Sure thing.
In 3, 2, 1.
Speaking of terrible ideas, the U.S. Army's Interim Combat Service Rifle is now officially deader than JFK, which is great because it's a really stupid idea. The Interim Combat Service Rifle was the idea that we're going to go back to 1950 and equip every soldier in the U.S. Army with a big, heavy rifle that was capable of full automatic fire and fired the 7.62 by 51mm cartridge, a full power cartridge. So this was a plan to backdoor resurrect that M14 that nobody actually liked and is a piece of garbage. It's a great way to ignore about 80 years of history, warfare, and small arms development, and also a great way to do that thing my grandfather told me never to do, which is make the same mistakes he did. 2 generations later, we should be making our own stupid mistakes, not rehashing our grandfather's dumb ideas, because some general was nostalgic for a big, heavy, loud Woodstock gun, or because he has some cockamamie notion of Russian super body armor that no one has seen.
Yeah. I think the worst part is that, like, there is already a 7.62 NATO rifle.
Yep.
In the U.S. Army's inventory.
Right. And that people don't like and don't carry and don't use because it's heavy.
Well, yeah. But, like, well, number one, it exists. And number two, like, you can buy a SCAR H. They make it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, like, there's no reason to buy a new rifle. I mean, we've already got that.
No,
that
we one. Don't need another program.
If you wanted a 7.62 long rifle, that yep. would be the one, because we've got the whole, like, SCAR thing already going.
Yep, it's right there. They work. They're really nice. They're actually pretty light as far as battle rifles go.
Yeah.
But you know, the assault rifle concept is the superior concept. Hint, the Germans also tested the battle rifle concept. It sucked.
Yep.
But, yeah, so I'm really happy that this one's dead. And it's just good to see it go. The Army kind of... It was really cool. They did a review kind of early in their project. And they discovered that, hey, you know, none of the actual people whose job it is to go shoot at stuff wants this. And it's expensive, and we have other things we'd rather do with the money.
Yeah.
Like fix our tanks, which we need to do, or whatever. So, some uncommon sense at the Pentagon for once. We're not going to say that very often on this show.
No, it's uncommon for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. But enough about bad idea weapons that we are so thankful have died a deserving death. Jay, what have you got for us today on the news?
Well, I've got another SpaceX topic, so if you give me the countdown, I will get going.
All right, SpaceX it is in 3, 2, 1, warp speed.
All right, so it's our old bugaboo again, Elon Musk and his SpaceX corporation. He's giving a presentation tonight, actually, in Adelaide, Australia, in about, 4 hours, I think. So you can go and verify any predictions I make for yourself. So we're likely to have the old interplanetary transit system, the SpaceX Mars rocket, was supposed to be a 42 rocket first stage in a 12 meter body, and that's just too big for SpaceX's current factories and current budget. So they decided to scale it down. We are expecting a 21 rocket engine in a 9 millimeter shell, which is a lot more reasonable. There's actually a market for rockets of that size. And it does raise the question still of how they're going to pay for it, because there aren't all that many enormous payloads to take into space. And, you know, that's kind of the typical question with SpaceX. They have these great ideas, but it's never altogether clear how they're going to make them pan out. Yeah.
You know, these giant rockets with huge clusters of engines remind me of that Russian program, the N1.
Which didn't work, but in
exploded.
In their defense, SpaceX seemed to have better engineers than... the Soviets in
they
the
probably
1960s.
Won't have a single turbopump responsible for most of the engines on a stage.
Right, actually, I think their classic Merlin or Raptor. It's one of their engines. I'm not sure if it's their Merlin, the one that's in the Falcon 9, or if they're going up to the Raptor, the bigger one for this. But they're kind of integral units. You can kind of scale them up and down as appropriate, and since there is no single point of failure in that system, except maybe if the whole thing explodes, like it has done, granted.
Oh, yeah. You know, rocketry is hard, kids.
Well, yeah. But failing that, there have been missions where SpaceX has had rockets fail, like an individual rocket on the first stage booster go out of commission, and the rocket still completes its mission. Because the whole thing about reusability is that it takes an extra margin of delta V to get the rocket back, and if you have a failure on the way up, you can just spend that delta V to get your payload to orbit and drop the rocket in the ocean like you would just ordinarily do.
Yep.
Which is nice. I mean, Musk is kind of a showman, I feel like.
Just a bit.
He never delivers exactly what he promises at first, and usually under-delivers, but it's still something worth watching usually when they get to the end of the project.
Yeah, plus it's rocketry. There could be cool explosions.
Exactly. I'm a little bit less sanguine about his latest venture, The Boring Company, which is to say a company that's based on boring underground tunnels.
Yes.
Because, you know, boring is really quite a good name for that particular field of endeavor. Fun fact, on the way back from a recent, my wife and I drove past a little construction zone, and we missed what the first sign said, but the second sign revealed all when it said, end boring area. And we were in Ohio at the time, so...
Oh, double boring.
Yep. Anyway, I'm kind of a Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin fanboy, which is a very unpopular position to take in the space nerd world. But the thing about Blue Origin is that it's funded entirely out of Mr. Amazon's pocket, which is really deep. And so they'll tell you what they're going to do, and then they'll eventually get around to doing it. Unlike nice. Musk, who says, we're going to go to Mars by 2022, and they haven't even launched their, you know...
Person to orbit yet.
Well, their person to orbit, or their Falcon Heavy.
Right.
That is supposed to be... Well, it was supposed to be late this year, but it's getting fairly late into the year, and I haven't heard much more news, so...
Huh. Well, you know, if we're talking about all these wondrous things, maybe we should think about wonder weapons.
Wunderwaffen. Yeah.
Yeah, Wunderwaffen.
Well, let's introduce us. Let's dive in.
Yeah, so our thought here was, this is kind of a recurring... We keep dancing around this theme, but the idea is, don't build tomorrow's Wunderwaffen today. And we've got a whole bunch of examples for you, but I'm going to kick us off with a tank example.
Oh, boy.
You're shocked, I know. In the 1960s, the U.S. Army had this really good main battle tank, the M60 Patton. And it was big and cool, and of course... You're always looking for the next best tank. So they made the A1 version, which was the standard incremental improvement, and then they built the A2 version, which was commonly called the Starship. And we'll have a link to a Wikipedia picture for you in the description, because this thing has an all-new turret design. It looks really goofy for, you know, the 1960s. Low-profile turret. It had a short 152mm, so 6-inch gun, that was designed to fire guided missiles or lob high explosive shells. It had fancy guidance systems, fancy everything. Super high tech and wonderful, right? Yeah, except nothing ever worked. And there were so many teething problems with the M60A2 that it never really did anything. And then you ended up with, by the time they actually fixed the problems and got it working-ish, you had the M60A3, which was a return to conventional tank development. And that was actually a more effective tank. It had a 105mm high-velocity gun that was more effective, even than the debugged missile gun thing.
I would like to note Starship. I would like to note that Shillelagh is a great name for a missile, though.
It is. Oh, the name was great. Everything else about the missile sucked. So you basically have, you know, normal, conventional, evolutionary tank development surpassed your stupid attempt to try to schedule a revolution.
Yeah.
And that's it. The M60A3 was built in larger numbers, was way more popular, and actually did what it was supposed to.
I'd like to bring up an example of my own, actually.
Certainly. Tag, you're it.
All right, well, we've got a pair of submarine classes. You have the Seawolf and the follow-on Virginias.
Virginias, yes. Yeah.
Now, the Seawolf was a Cold War masterpiece, the very highest end of submarine technology, custom-built systems as far as the eye can see, which isn't very far because you're inside a submarine, but still.
Well, you know, that skin is, it runs silent, but it also runs very deep.
All the systems you can see inside the submarine, the very highest end. And it turned out that these were really expensive submarines. It wasn't quite like the Starship in that they weren't trying to do new things. They were just trying to do the very best of everything possible as much as they possibly could. And,
another common problem.
Yeah. And it turns out we couldn't afford that, especially when the Cold War ended. We have, two or three of them now?
Three,
yeah. So, fast forward a couple of years, and they're thinking, well, the Los Angeleses are still getting pretty long in the tooth, and we need submarines, so let's design something new. And what they did was they designed a submarine that was made to be, was designed to be built in, you know, modules and then assembled at the end, It used a lot of off-the-shelf technology. It used things that the Seawolf granted had proved, but, you know, the Seawolf was never supposed to be a test bed. It was supposed to be the, you know, the combat class of submarine. And
right.
So rather than building kind of an experimental thing they could use to prove technologies and then make them cheaper later on, they tried to throw the kitchen sink into the Seawolf. And they made something they couldn't afford to buy, and they had to wait longer than they probably should have to start replacing the Los Angeleses with the Virginias. The Virginia is a pretty universally a well-regarded nuclear submarine.
It's a great attack sub.
Well, because they were able to synthesize lessons from both the previous class of good submarines, like the previous class of large purchased submarines,
Los Angeles,
the Los Angeles class, and bring in some but not all of those technologies from the Seawolf, and even add a couple of new ones, like the photonics mast, which is to say a periscope that's a camera instead of lenses.
Right. The other nice thing about the Virginias is, partially due to the modularity, partially due to the long production run, you can roll in improvements, so the later ones have a whole bunch of things the earlier ones don't. And that's kind of nice to do if you design something modular with some expansion room and, you know, room to grow. And keep building them.
It's also true that I'm sure it's very easy to make a long hull version of a modular submarine.
Right. Yeah. You can just make it, add another.
Throw in a VLS section here.
Yep.
But yeah, so the Virginia is an excellent submarine that uses the lessons learned from a poor predecessor. Well, not poor, just perhaps even too rich.
Yeah, well, and I think there's two different mistakes that we've highlighted here. With the Seawolf, you have this inability to say no. This inability to recognize that you need some number of units that you have to compromise at some point. Cost is a dependent variable, right? It needs to be controlled with everything else. So that's a classic problem. And but the M68-2 Starship is we're trying to schedule a revolution. Yeah. Revolutions happen. We're not trying to say they're not. We're not trying to say that you shouldn't embrace what you have. For example, not embracing smokeless powder would have been profoundly stupid.
Right.
But at the same time, you, designers, engineers, etc., don't get to say revolution's happening tomorrow, be there. Yeah. No, that's not you. That's not for you.
Now, it is possible to swing too far in the direction the Virginias swing in, which is to say it's possible to design something that's too evolutionary and too modular and and too made to just, we're going to build as many of these as we can.
Right.
And you know where I'm going with this, right? It's our favorite punching bag, the little crappy ship. The littoral combat ship is all of the things... It does all the things that Virginia does right wrong.
It's too modular. Well, the one thing that the little crappy ship has that isn't modular is a power plant fixation. It's designed to win drag races at sea. Unfortunately, we're not in some bizarro anime world where drag races at sea are how things are decided.
Yep.
Because this would make an awesome boat in an anime, because you could just go, like, a bajillion knots and, you know, totally beat everybody in the, you know, drag race to win the girl's heart.
There are some fascinating, like, design compromises made in terms of, like, hull shape, too. I'm a big fan of I think the Trimaran is underexplored and probably will be underexplored for the foreseeable future, because it was done so poorly this time. But yeah, they built a ship with a mission bay and no built-in capabilities. Now, to put those capabilities on, it's proven to be very expensive, and...
even the base ship isn't cheap.
Right. It's that power plant again, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And like, you need to drive, like, a multi-thousand-ton ship at, you know, 45 or 50 knots. You need a lot of engine for that.
Yep.
And engine is not cheap.
Nope. And the engine means you also need fuel, cooling, you gotta vent all that exhaust, you gotta bring in intake air, you have to have gearing to drive those screws, you know, just... It's one of those, speed gets expensive really fast.
Yeah.
And you can actually see this, a slightly more practical version of the same issue with if you look at the Iowa class, battleships.
Hmm.
Wonderful ships. But in a lot of ways, they're not that much of an improvement over the preceding class, the South Dakotas. And a lot of that can be pointed at the fact that the South Dakotas have a moderate speed requirement of 27 knots, and the Iowas were supposed to keep pace with fast carriers. And can do 33 or more knots, you know, that fine U.S. Navy tradition of lying through your teeth about speed.
Mm-hmm. Which, well, it's a fascinating thing, the Iowa generally, but that's kind of outside the scope of tonight's discussion. So
yes, exactly.
Hold my tongue for now. But yeah, there is, of course, another set of examples that we had in mind, that being an Air Force example.
Right. Are you alluding to the F-35?
I am.
All right. Well, see, the F-35 is a tricky one, and I hesitate to bring it up in this particular context, if only because we haven't seen the final bill, and we haven't seen them do very much yet. The F-35 is testing the notion of concurrency as a manufacturing technique, and I'm not entirely sold on it, but to be fair, the test isn't over, the mission isn't finished. And I think the other tricky thing about testing this sort of thing is that you have to wait till the end, because otherwise you don't have the contrapositive. You don't have another fighter program sitting around that was developed in the traditional way at the same time for you to look at and say, gee, which one ended up better?
Yeah.
So now, with all of those said, there have been an awful lot of software problems. There have been an awful lot of delays and bugs and issues with the fighter. And there probably would have been a nicer way to develop this thing in stages.
Yeah. I suppose the F-22 has kind of Seawolf syndrome too, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of the F-35 systems have been kind of backported to the F-22 because, you know, it'd be great if... The F-22 is a wonderful air superiority machine, but we also would like it to carry bombs, and the bays are really small.
Well, actually, I've got a little exercise here. So, John, why don't you give me the type numbers of the most successful fourth-generation fighters of the U.S. Like, not just the numbers, but, you know, the variant letter.
Well, let's see. You'd have the F-15 Charlie.
That's right.
Eagle. The Strike Eagle, so E, Echo. Mm-hmm. The F-16 Charlie, various blocks of same. FA-18, fighter attack nonsense. Yeah. Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot.
Yeah.
So nothing really higher than Foxtrot, and they tend to, and Charlie's a pretty recurring letter in there.
Yeah, so I'll note that neither of those are, none of those rather are A.
Well, that's correct.
Yeah.
No, A, we went past A pretty quick.
And I think that's kind of something we've gotten away from. Building a platform that fits a minimum mission requirement, maybe not like a fantastic one. The F-16A was built for a stupid requirement.
Yeah, and even the A was an improvement over the original nonsensical requirement.
Right.
Let's be fair.
But yeah, you've got a dumb requirement, something made to do that requirement and more. And then because the requirement was, if dumb, required like a lot of a low wing loading and a high thrust. So you could put a lot more onto it.
Right. And you could trade away some of that wing loading and thrust for load. Though, let's bring up the F-16. I'm going to pick on it just another point. The F-16 is probably the most successful fourth-generation fighter ever, and certainly up there for candidate of one of the greatest fighters of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a phenomenal machine. The original design goal, the Fighter Mafia, was profoundly dumb. The notion of we're going to have two heat-seeker missiles, a gun, and a range-only radar, what the hell is that? In the 70s? Are you kidding me?
You could have had another F-5, right?
Yeah, well, actually, that was basic. That order was really curiously like, we're going to buy the same thing the F-5 was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And never mind that Northrop is busy trying to gain more sales by adding capabilities to the F-5. No, shut up. We want the F-5 that we didn't buy. And didn't, again, buy in the 70s. They could have bought more F-5E Tiger IIs, right?
Yeah.
That would have solved the problem, but they didn't go that way.
Yeah, so, and that's an interesting point generally, just the we've mentioned before, the after Vietnam lessons where the Russians said, we should build ourselves an F-4, and the Americans said, we should build a MiG-21.
Right, and very much a grass is greener lesson, because the Americans had their big fat fighters, and they said, you know, we're getting clobbered in these stupid dogfights because we can't turn with them, those stupid MiG-21s, and they're small and hard to see. And they're just so infuriating. And the Russians took the lessons from, you know, sending pilots to Vietnam and training and said, God, you know, those American fighters are so annoying with all their stupid missiles and that giant radar that always knows where we are.
Evgeny, they shot me from 10 miles away.
I didn't even see him. Wouldn't that be awesome, right?
He's not very sporting, though.
Exactly. So they built the MiG-23, which is, you know, a Russian F-4, basically. And, you know, it's got missile-focused armament. It's got a pretty big radar for the Russians in the 70s anyway. It's got a nice big engine, swing wings. You know, it's a hot rod.
Well, kind of like if you'd built the Tomcat 5 or 10 years earlier.
Yeah, same kind of idea, that big interceptor,
yeah.
You know, fleet defense sort of thing. Motherland defense, right?
Must defend Motherland.
Yeah, and the Russians, I mean, they did love their interceptors.
Yeah, they had reason. They had a lot more stuff that needed protection by interceptors than we ever did.
Right. Yeah, just the geographic puzzle of defending Russia from air attack is a really wonderful one, actually.
We'll do a segment on that sometime.
And by wonderful, I mean it sucks so much.
Defend the indefendable.
Right. Yeah. No. I would totally, do a defend the motherland against, fascist invaders.
Oh, I'll make a note of that on the notes then.
Or I guess the Chinese, but potato, potato, right? All right. So, our second one, our second topic for the day, since I think we've covered military nicely, is kind of a new take on a topic we've done. We talk about games a bunch. We both like to play games.
Mm-hmm.
And a variation on this is we're starting this tonight. We may revisit this as we feel like it. But basically, this is a retrospective look on a classic game. And the notion here is that one of us is going to introduce a game to the other one, an older game. But, the codes still check out.
Yeah.
And something you can make run. And so in this case, we started this. I decided to introduce Jay to the old game Deus Ex, which came out in 2000.
Ooh, dead on 2000.
Yeah, so it's a cyberpunk kind of RPG. It's old school hard in a lot of ways. It's got a lot of weird quirks.
Cyberpunk RPG shooter, to be accurate.
Yeah, cyberpunk, like if we're going to play genre roulette here, cyberpunk RPG shooter. And it's a really interesting game that I have played to death as a teenager. And so now we're going to see how it held up. So, Jay, we'll just take it to you. We'll start with what you thought, and then I'll talk about what I, not quite a rebuttal, but my, points in the game.
Well, I'm going to start with the blocky, poorly texture-mapped elephant in the room.
Oh, God.
Which is to say, this is a game from 2000. It's kind of the dawn of 3D graphics, more or less. Like the dawn of the 3D shooter, I suppose. It was some years until Call of Duty would blow our socks off, and
about four, I think.
Yeah, it was 2004, I think. But it's a classic, I guess I'll say, to be a little bit generous.
No, you don't have to be generous. I'll be like, even I'm a fan of the game, and I'll tell you, it looks like crap.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit before I think they should have really gone full 3D.
Yeah, they're trying to do too much. Now, what's interesting is at the time, even at the time, this really wasn't a barn burner in terms of performance requirements. But no, it definitely the graphics are the easy for any old game. The graphics are the easiest thing to pick on, and they deserve it,
And pick on them we will.
Damn right.
Yeah. So at any rate, the graphics are a bit difficult to get over, but I tend to have a pretty good ability to get past that sort of thing.
Right.
We'll kind of move on to the gameplay. I only played through the first kind of intro level, which starts you on the south dock of Liberty Island in New York, where you're looking at the blown up Statue of Liberty and the bits that have fallen down and whatnot. And you're part of a UN anti-terrorism task force of some kind, because the only thing lamer than FEMA that they mention in the intro is the UN.
Yep. Yeah. And this is also like an artifact of the 2000s, right? This is still Clinton era gaming. And so we still hadn't quite gotten used to the fact the UN is useless and sucks at its job.
Right. So you're on Liberty Island. You're tasked with going into the statue as a test of your abilities or whatever. And fix something. So you as this cyberpunk detective cop, anti-terrorism puncher guy, have these fancy nano augmentations that you can use to, I suppose the only one I had was to light up the room in front of me. But
yep.
there were I assume there are other ones that.
Oh yeah, there's quite a lot.
I would have learned as I gone along.
We may revisit this in the future so he can play with all the fancy augmentations.
Well, yeah, that's probably a good idea. But this is just my first impressions.
Yeah, exactly.
So playing through the game, I watched the guards kind of walk up almost right next to me while I'm kind of crouched in a corner, then look around and walk away. Shot him with a tranquilizer dart in the back, and he fell over. Well, he first started shooting at me, then ran away and fell over, and other guards kind of didn't care much. But I'm willing to give that a pass. For one, a stealth game with the, truly accurate way of... Though the truly accurate rendition of stealth wouldn't be all that much fun. And for another, it's the early 2000s, and, we didn't have all kinds of computing power we could throw at the problem.
Right.
The movement is, you know, surprisingly not terribly clunky for a game of its age. I suppose it's still kind of in the early age of the shooter, but they do the aiming and the moving around works without too much fuss.
Yep.
The aiming is kind of interesting. It's, of course, an RPG hybrid sort of thing, so you don't have any aim down sights. That, of course, came along a little bit later in the genre's history anyway. And
4 years later.
Yes. Call of Duty. Anyway, so you'd kind of point your pistol, and when you're standing still, your reticle shrinks until you've finally stabilized your aim, which isn't altogether inaccurate. I mean, I'm willing to allow that as a gameplay thing.
Yeah.
A little bit of stealth. I'm not a big stealth game person, which I think is something that kind of caused me to bounce off it in the way that I did.
Right.
That first level, I'm told, has quite a bit of sneaking around because you don't have the ammunition to go. Well, to go in guns blazing yet. And,
right. You really have to, like, play with some degree of guile. I'm not a big stealth gameplay fan either. And even in this game, where I think the stealth is compelling mostly because of how bad the AI is and how bad the line of sight the enemies is, so you can really mess with them quite a bit. And that's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll have to go into it with that in mind, as I'm going to mess with AI people today.
Right.
And you have to play with quite a bit of, like, guile and beat people over the head with a crowbar from behind, because the game doesn't really give you a lot of ammo initially.
Yeah.
And that gets better, but, you know, it's still one of those frustrations from, you know, back in the days when early levels were old school hard and AD&D level 1 was, you're gonna die, dude.
Right. Well, yeah, and that is kind of a sign of the times. It's something we've moved past and something I prefer the other way around. To go off on a very slight tangent, there are only two stealth games that I find that I've really liked in my time as a gamer. That would be Mark of the Ninja from Clay Interactive and Invisible Incorporated, also from Clay Interactive. And the thing that both of those do is they give you nearly perfect information. You can see what the enemy can see, and you can see more or less where the enemy is going in both cases. And
right.
That makes the stealth game more of a puzzle than kind of like that heart-pounding, oh no, is he going to see me thing.
Right.
Which I think is worthwhile, and I believe other good examples of the genre did that too. The Thief games gave you that little jewel that you could see
mm-hmm.
to say whether or not you were, you know, doing something visible or not. And
right. The one thing I will say in defense of Deus Ex's stealth gameplay, and this is probably less deliberate than I would like it to be, the one nice thing about a stealth gameplay is, again, because of the weird limitations of the AI and the fact that the soldiers don't really communicate with each other, a screw-up is very much less than fatal. It's not necessarily a fight. You know, I mean, you might die from the combat, but often in stealth games, screwing up stealth means you're going to be slapping the quick load button.
Yeah.
Really, like, oh, I'm detected, shit, and you hit the button and you just reload, you load last save. And where even if you can fight your way through the sequence, you're in such a crappy place afterwards. You know, your health is gone, you're bleeding out, your ammo is gone. A lot of the Splinter Cell games do a bad job of this. That, you know, really, even though you can survive through three alarms or whatever before they call your mission over, often one is really too many.
Yeah.
And even if you survive, you're too dead to finish the mission. So one of the nice things with Deus Ex is that as long as you can get through that combat, you know, so you get through a couple of the levels, you'll get there and see it. You get through the combat and then you can act like, hey, you know, it's okay. I can approach this next sequence of rooms or whatever. You know, kind of scot-free. Everything's reset. It's okay, I'm not going to die and be swarmed by robots.
Speaking of mashing the quick load button, that was a memorable moment in my play.
Yes!
Also, I was engaging in some light platforming when John, sitting beside me and listening to the game, says, that sounds like somebody's shooting at you. So I turn around and see a guard down on the ground below aiming a tranquilizer gun at me. The platforming, I should note, was not nearly as annoying as I expected it to be.
Surprisingly.
It's before the era of the, you know, run forward and press the X button to platform mechanic.
It's which, also before the era, well, it's between eras. Third person was not in vogue at this time.
Right. I should point out that I said that even as somebody who's been playing a lot of Warframe lately, which is probably the game with the best freeform movement I've ever encountered, and I was like, it's obviously a 2000 game and your options are walk, run, crouch, and jump. I'm not sure there's even a walk. It's like run, crouch, and jump. But it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
The jumping makes sense. You're allowed to adjust your, you know, momentum in midair, which is the most important part of any first or third person platforming game, I would say.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was standing there.
Shot at.
I was standing there on these crates getting shot at, and oh no, I've been shot at. And of course, I was low on health from earlier from a couple of gunfights I had engaged in. And so the one tranquilizer dart was enough to kill me. So even though I had hit the guard a couple of times and taken him down, I slowly bled out and died myself.
Right.
So on John's advice, happily, I had hit the quick save button immediately prior to beginning this platforming sequence. Or rather, in the middle of it, when I was already up on the crate and the guy was already running toward me.
Yep.
So I...
Before I realized he was being shot at, to be fair.
Right, so I hit the quick load button and turned to the side and was suddenly struck again by a dart in the face. And yep. Once again, I killed the guy and bled out myself. And this repeated for several iterations in several different ways. Once or twice, I jumped down and chased the guy, and he still hit me with a dart, obviously, because he had time to aim. And eventually, I managed to just kind of Texas quick draw him and get him on the first shot. And that was... It's kind of something you wouldn't get in a modern game, just because the health system wouldn't work that way, or they'd give you a little bit more, a little bit more breathing room when loading. Or as in, there's a memorable Twitter thread floating around about various cheats that game designers use. One of them being that the first time an enemy shoots at you, he's almost 100% guaranteed to miss because it's no fun getting struck out of the blue. And Deus Ex being, you know, kind of more classic game before such player-friendly contrivances were. Contrived?
Yes, before they were contrived.
Yes. Well, before those things existed. I was hit several times just kind of out of the blue and didn't know what to do with myself. And despite the fact that it was frustrating, I think it makes for a better story than a lot of modern games do. And that's one of the things I like about retro games.
Yes.
They don't treat you with kid gloves. They expect you, no, you're playing badly. You deserve to die.
Right.
And you shouldn't have quick saved there. You should have looked around and made sure there was nobody trying to shoot you first, you moron.
Yeah. That's another thing. Modern games tend to separate platforming and combat a lot better.
Well, that, and they tend to, you know, feature checkpoints of some kind.
Right. This game has no checkpoints at all, you know, save of your own accord or...
Yeah. It is difficult to do in an open world game, but not, like, really terribly difficult.
Right. And this is, like, kind of a weird hybrid. It's sort of open world and sort of not. You don't see it much on the first level other than choice of approach, but you do have somewhat areas where you can roam in and accomplish objectives and find side quests, but it's constrained and you're always kind of nudged in the direction of a mission in a none too subtle way.
Mm-hmm. But I think it still kind of counts as something vaguely open world, just by nature of its genre. It's
yep.
Being an RPG shooter.
Yep.
The RPG part has a... Well, besides the skill tree and everything, not tree, but the skill, like, page
list
and everything.
Thing.
Gaining experience and putting it into things. There is, even in that first level with its constraints, there's kind of that open worldish feel. Mm-hmm. There's not an objective marker flashing over there saying, go along that way.
Or
to go back to Call of Duty, like a Russian guy waving you forward and saying, come on, or forward.
Right. You have to listen to conversations and figure out where the dude is you're supposed to capture.
If man with rifle dies, man with bullets takes rifle and shoots.
One of the other nice things that I liked is that often the game will give you freedom to screw up a little bit in a controlled way, but still, it's a lot more than a lot of other games do. So Jay eventually found the terrorist leader at the top of the ruined statue and requested and asked him, demanded that he surrender. Yes, demanded, not asked. Demanded his surrender, and he does. Now, at this point, you can interrogate him as Jay did. Jay being the, you know, good cop or whatever the hell you want to call it this week.
As much of a good cop as a nano-augmented cyberpunk.
Dude with a
NATO
really long
anti-terrorist killy man.
UN thing can be.
Well, the long trench coat, I think, is really the true indicator of character.
Yeah. But you did have the option there to kill him. And this is a legitimate option. You can kill him, and many of your coworkers will be upset with you. Some will like you. And that's it.
Yep.
You're done. There's another thing that, like, you had kind of an unwritten bonus objective to free Gunther Hermann. But you didn't. Now, he survived. He got freed by somebody else. But you didn't get the bonus for rescuing him in terms of money that you could spend later, right?
And he received a little cheesed off at me when I...
Exactly.
When I pop by to say, hey, how's it going? He's like, well, you could have rescued me.
Yeah.
Except in a German accent and a little bit more subtle.
Right. So, you know, but that, and that, I think, is something that is really, is definitely missing to the detriment of modern games. In that you don't really have choices, you know, in illusion. And it depresses me because you can make that illusion a lot more convincing by giving me some, like, obvious differences. And I don't mean colors, BioWare. You know, some, like, obvious little cues where it took them another couple minutes in the recording studio to give me some alternative lines. If you shot the guy they told you to rescue or left your buddy to rot in jail for, you know, another hour or so until the goons backing you up found him. So that's definitely an improvement.
Yeah.
Or, you know, something that was improved back then.
But yeah, a little classic game retrospective. Yeah. I think it's interesting. I'll probably play some more of it, too, just to get a better sense for the fuller...
Right. It gets fun the fuller experience. When you get to pick augmentations and when you get to have things that make you invisible or shoot down incoming missiles and all kinds of fun things like that.
Yeah.
So yeah. Those get lots and lots of fun. All the different augmentations once you get those. And again, once you get out of the first level, you get a little more freedom of action in terms of how you want to play stuff. The combat remains old school lethal.
Yeah. I do have in mind a game for John to play at some point, but we'll come to that when we come to that, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that takes us to our third and final topic for the night, and that is, of course, our guns topic, our wonderful guns topic.
We love you, guns.
So, as you know, or you may not know if you haven't been listening to our episodes in the past, you should go back and listen to our archive. It's good stuff. But this year, we started shooting USPSA. I shot in production with my little Beretta M9. John shot in open with his Glock blaster, the Vickers-style Glock, isn't it? With the
Roland. Not Vickers.
Right. Whatever.
But whatever.
One of those names in a Glock.
Yeah.
So, you know, the compensator and the optic and everything. So anyway, to recap the season really quickly, we both ended up, I believe, with a C rating in our chosen division.
Yep.
Which is a little bit more impressive for John than for me, given the lesser suitability of the Glock blaster for open compared to the M9 in production.
That's you know, unusually for me, that is a handicap per the rules of the division.
Yeah.
You know, remember that the other thing to point out here is that when you're shooting in a particular division, production, open, limited, whatever, you're competing against other shooters in that division. So Jay and I have different requirements to meet to get our C ticket
right.
In the division. And it's only good and meaningful in that division.
Right. So my production C is not comparable to John's open C, which is not comparable to my production C.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. No, it's a different problem. It's a different game.
So for me, at least, I decided I wanted to tackle a different problem for next year. I wanted to move up to the limited division, which is to say something that has power factor scoring in USPSA if you have a... Well, in limited, at least. If you're using something 40 and larger, more or less, it's got a... There's a formula, but 40 Smith & Wesson factory ammo and up, yep. Approximately. You get scored more forgivingly than if you're shooting something smaller. So everyone shoots the high power factor ammo because it is a... Well,
better.
Advantageous.
Yep.
So I needed to buy myself something in 40, and I needed to fit it out as a race gun, which is to say with a lightened trigger and big magazines and fancy fiber optic front sight. So I went and bought myself a CZP09, and you can read my review of that and also a better explanation of what I did on the website, which we will link in the show description. So I guess we'll start real quick with the internals. I went out to Cajun Gunworks and bought the works kit, basically. I got their short reset kit, which both shortens the reset and improves the trigger pull. I got lightened springs of all kinds, and I also got front sight. Well, sights, but we'll come to that in a second.
Yeah.
So I went up to John's one evening, and together we muscled all the parts in. The CZ is interestingly arranged internally.
Yeah. It's one way to put it.
Well, the most annoying part, I think, was the trigger, and I'm sure John will back me up on that. To explain it real quick, the trigger rides inside the frame, of course, like you'd expect a trigger to do. It has to connect with the trigger bar, of course, to actuate the action bits. And in the middle, there is a spring. The spring is one of those, there's a word for it, but one of those springs that's got a tail on each end. One end of the tail goes... One tail goes into the trigger assembly itself, and one lays forward on the frame so that the spring is sprung when you pull the trigger back. And that's just impossible to get in with one set of hands, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, it was even tricky with two. See, you know, the Czechs strike me as some bizarre elves of the gun world. Because they're always, you know, doing their own thing a little different, a little weird. And not always wrong, but a little weird. And in this case, I feel like there's a better way to handle that trigger bit than what they came up with.
I should note that I was able to do the Beretta trigger all by myself with, right, like, zero trouble.
Yeah, and we've talked about me being able to do whatever you please to a Glock trigger, you know, almost blindfolded.
We've had it on the show. John's, like, completely stripped a Glock and put it back together in, like, 3 minutes.
Yep. Now, granted, the Glock is, you know, super simple in that regard, but the basic, like, one person with the requisite tools, now granted that's a short list on the Glock, but whatever, one person with the requisite tools can easily make any change he pleases on his Glock with very little trouble. Right. One person with the requisite amount of tools, you know, and of course knowledge for both of these, can easily make whatever changes he pleases on his Beretta M9 with a minimum of trouble.
And that was not our experience with the CZ.
No.
The trigger was, of course, the really hard part. Getting the action back together was mostly me being an idiot and not looking at the picture I took of the action before I took it all apart. Mm-hmm. But to explain that a little bit more, everything basically besides the trigger rides on one common pin.
Right.
The double action roller bearing, the firing pin lifter, the sear itself, and I guess the ejector is retained by that pin, but not actually, like, pierced by it. It's just kind of underneath and pressed up by a spring. So getting it out wasn't all that bad, but getting it up, there's kind of a lot of fiddling and making sure everything's lined up just right. And there's a little tricky bit where you've got to make sure the trigger bar is underneath the disconnector so that it can, you know, actuate the disconnector up and trip the sear. It's not a straightforward gun to take apart and put back together, but I think the results were pretty great.
Yeah, it's a big improvement.
Action at the end, we measured it, measured the trigger pull at 3.5 pounds, and it feels, I feel like it feels lighter than that, even. It's one of those things where the crispness is more important than the weight, as John's fond of saying, and we put an awful lot of crispness in.
Yep. It's still long, but it isn't long in an objectionable way.
I think long, I don't know, I feel like you have an idea of long that's kind of tainted by striker-fired pistols. I don't count take-up as part of a trigger pull, necessarily. That's something you should be able to work out with practice.
Well, I think the other thing is, remember, my other heavy trigger experience is with, lots of single-action shooting with 1911s and old, lovingly tuned by lots of shooting, Smith & Wesson revolvers, both of which have a trigger that has negligible amounts of travel, period.
Yeah, just basically zero take-up, because there's nothing else to have to do.
There's nothing there. Yeah, you just...
Yeah, there is no requirement for a longer trigger pull, like there is on a double-action gun, so it just can't move in that fashion.
Right.
Anyway, as a lifetime double-action shooter, it doesn't bother me.
And, right. Well, and let's also point this out, that's the important thing.
Exactly.
It's your gun.
Yep.
Mine, you know, I might say, that's a little long for my taste, but I will say it is a big improvement on what you had before. And it certainly isn't really an objectionable trigger. And the rest of it is preference, and we have different preferences.
Yep.
So,
but anyway, yeah, so that does bring us to
the praise of that trigger.
Something we're not going to sing the praises of, the sights.
Oh, my
God. I need to read John's note exactly here, because it's so pitch perfect. The Dawson so-called, air quotes, precision Rust-O-Matic fit-me-lots sights. And that is bang-on accurate.
It is. That quote was pretty easy to come up with because if I had experience with Dawson sights, I mess with sights a lot. I've bought sights from Dawson, Trigicon, Heine, Warren, various Glock factory type sights. I've dealt with HK factory sights in and out. Am I missing any? I think that covers everything. And the one that stands out to me negatively are the Dawson sights.
They come with a warning saying they're going to rust, basically. And there's nothing you can do about it.
And they're not kidding. They don't know what a finish is, apparently.
Well, even if they did, you've got to file so much of it off to get the stupid things into the gun in the first place.
Though. Right.
Yeah.
They also don't know. And this is the other thing that bothers me. So, of all the sights that I've bought, the only sight I've had rust problems with are Dawson sights. which, as you've pointed out, may be related to the fact that the only site that I have to do serious fitting to are the Dawson sites. All of the others I could get in a few minutes with a hammer and a punch or a sight pusher on my Glocks, because I have one. I mess with sights a lot. But with a minimum of fuss and maybe a little bit of filing, the kind of like, man, this is a nice 2-minute job, you know, between commercial breaks of a television show, and I'm done.
Yeah. I would like to point out that the front sight, at least, wasn't nearly as painful as the rear sight. The rear sight was like 20 minutes of filing and testing and having to hammer it back out because it wasn't quite filed down just enough to fit in to the dovetail.
And I don't get it. These are all of the guns we've talked about, because I haven't changed the sights on my 1911. All of the guns we've talked about have standardized dovetails. And actually, I take that back, because even if I had changed my sights on 1911, other people who aren't Dawson who make 1911 sights will specify which brands they work with.
Yeah.
And they will all, and now they also sell a gunsmith blank, but the gunsmith blank is supposed to be grossly oversized to fit anything because it's for a gunsmith to fit and probably refinish.
Right.
But when we're buying sights for a pistol made relatively recently by one single manufacturer, you ought to be able to come pretty frickin' close.
I also want to quibble with CZ's use of a very, very, very strong and high temperature kind of a heat sensitive glue on the front sight.
Oh, yeah. Super Loctite or whatever they use.
Yeah, I had to take it to a gunsmith to get the front sight out. Even I put in the vise in my mom's basement and hit it with like a kitchen lighter for 5 minutes, and I still couldn't get it to budge. And it took the guy at the gun shop quite a bit of hammering himself. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, that about wraps that up.
I
want to point out that also that it was a very good idea to mark the position of the rear sight with a pencil. That was that was quality.
That is a good idea. Yeah. I will take a quick minute to point out a couple other things I'd like. I personally prefer the horizontal crosswise dovetail on the front sight. And I want to give props to Heine sights for having they have easy fit sights, which are exactly what they say on the tin. The front sight, I got them for my VP9. The front sight is a dovetail, and it's a little bit undersized because it has two set screws, one on either side of the blade. So you slide it in, and you can use your finger to move it because it's nice and light, and then you crank down the set screws with some Loctite, and you're good to go. And the rear sight is even neater, actually. What he did is he cut a pocket into it, and there's two set screws that press on a little metal rod that goes in the pocket. So again, it's nice and loose. You can move it with your finger real easily on the range to get it just where you want. And then you crank down the set screws, and it's going nowhere. It's a really cool system, and it's kind of a shame that he's probably patented the hell out of it.
Yeah.
Because that was actually what it said on the tin, easy to work with. But most of the other ones that I've dealt with, you know, the Warren sights I bought for my Glock, I really like. And they work great. The Trigicons I've bought have been great. You know, so everybody else seems to have their act together, and Dawson's still living in like the 60s or something.
Yeah. Anyway, I was trying to hurry you along because you got like, I don't know, maybe five or 8 minutes left to get your entire gigantic open checklist down. So I'm just going to sit back and let you talk.
All right. So in open, the Glock is not really ideal for the same scoring methods that Jay's mentioned, plus issues of tuning with the way the springs are balanced, and the slide mounted optic is suboptimal. And when I started looking into getting a 2011, a high-capacity 1911 design made, because that's how you do it, you notice very quickly that there are a plethora of options. There you can get a titanium comp, a steel comp that is detachable, a steel comp that is all one piece of the barrel, a so-called true-bore type comp. You can get bull barrels, a bushing barrel with a cone compensator mount. You can get a sleeve for your barrel. You can have the sleeve made of steel. You can have it made of tungsten. You can have a whole variety of slide weights, of cutouts, heavy slides, light slides. You can put barrel porting. You can do inline, you know, vertically along the top. You can do V porting. You can do both. How many ports do you want? How big port do you want? You know, do you want the ports angled? Do you want them, like, shaped funny? There's polymer grips, aluminum grips, steel grips, because on a high-cap 1911, the frame and the grip are two separate pieces. So the grip module, you know, you buy separately and you get your choice of bit, right? There's barrel length, short, medium, and long. Long is a threaded government model barrel. So a 5-inch slide, 5.4-inch barrel. Medium is about 5-inch overall. And then shorty is usually about 4.5 or so length barrel. You can stroke the recoil system, which is basically using a longer recoil system, than would otherwise be indicated by your barrel to get more unlocking time.
Lovely hot rotting term.
Yeah, it really is great. You know, ported, relieved, stroked, and bored. Those terms all apply to 2011s. You got your optics. You got your big Seymour, the slide, classic slide ride, railway. You've got the mini optics, and everybody and their uncle makes one of those now. And then, and one of the things that started driving me crazy was that you can't actually get any kind of consensus. The more you look, the worse it gets, and you get in this choice paralysis hell. And the reason why you get there is because none of this actually frickin' matters. Any reasonable configuration you can think of, you can find someone who's winning with that configuration. It doesn't matter. What actually matters, okay, is your gun reliable? That's usually the one people screw up because they mess with their guns too much, or because they're not carefully reloading, or because they're not taking care of their magazines, or their magazines are, you know, too old and the springs are dead. But is your gun reliable? In open, do you have a reasonably recent compensator design? Do you have an optic on it, a dot? And, I mean, you can do it without those, but you're really leaving points on the table. Those make it easier for you to do your part. But it's all on you. It doesn't matter. Any short, any permutation of the list of features above, you can find someone who's winning with that. Because it's all what you get used to and what, you know, you practiced with and know. So that said, what does matter? Like I said, reliability. You know, some basic checkbox features which you get because you told the guy you want an open gun. Super simple, right?
Right.
And there's one other thing that matters. It's got to look good. And now that sounds like vanity. Okay, it partially is because who wants a lame-looking gun? But that's also the resale value of these. If you ever want to sell the gun, if you ever want to sell it, you know, to fund a new gun or whatever.
And you probably will want that at some point.
Yeah, if you're going to want a new gun, you might as well sell the old one. You know, you only need the one backup, really. It's not like a Glock. Like with my Glock 17, I know how much that's worth. It's Glock 17. It's used. You can work out a price like inside of 2 minutes. It's obvious. This is a custom gun. You know, it's not really like a lot of other custom guns. There's not a good sample. Basically, it's worth quite literally whatever the other guy's willing to pay, and that's super dependent on the other guy.
Right, so it's quite a lot like a custom house, actually, yeah, in that sense.
Yep, exactly. So you want, and there's not desirable features is what's fashionable and what the other guy likes. So it's really important that if you want to sell it, if your gun looks cool, that'll help you get some of your money back. You'll never get everything back, again, just like the custom house, but you can get somewhere. So what am I thinking, right? That's what we want to hear. I'm sure Jay's over there, like, sitting on edge of the table.
I'm stroking my beard thoughtfully, actually.
Mm-hmm. So thinking, probably going to start with a full-length government-length slide. Everyone want to put it a long barrel design. That's a 5.4-inch barrel plus comp. The 5.4 includes the length for threading. Those are a little softer. Those are a little easier to load for. I haven't done a lot of 38 super comp. It's going to be a 38 super comp. There you go. Caliber major hand loading. So something pretty simple, straightforward. This one, I'll let the Smith, if he's really a big fan of a medium, of a MIDI, mid-length gun, he might talk me down to a medium. We're not going shorter than medium. I don't really want to deal with the excessive... just the excessiveness of the short one, the short guns. It takes a lot more powder. They tend to be harsh to shoot. And I'm not really interested in that right now. So right now, long gun, long barrel gun, full length slide. We're going to lighten the slide reasonably. Don't want to go too crazy on it because I'd really rather not have it crack. Also, again, I think a bit of the slide stuff's overrated, but we're going to cut it down. I'm probably just going to tell the Smith to go nuts and make it look awesome. Pick some cuts that look cool. Try to get it probably around 10 and a half or so. Mm. Titanium compensator.
Nice.
I actually have one in mind. That one I'm going to get a little particular about because there's a guy in Washington that designed one with computational fluid dynamics, which is something I know something about. I've done some CFD analysis. It's really fun. But also, if I look at it, it makes sense to me intuitively based on what I know about, say, a triple expansion engine, where to get maximum use of high-pressure steam, you run it through a series of pistons, and the smallest piston is first, and then you go to a mid-sized piston, and then last, a large piston. And in the CFD design comp from Binary Engineering, we have a small port, a small expansion chamber, a medium expansion chamber, and then a large expansion chamber. Curiously, this is opposite to how a lot of other compensators do it, and I think that's probably because, I don't know, they just built, they probably just extended it over time, just like, well, I'll just add another bit
yeah.
or something. So that's the one we're going with. Again, a lot of this is kind of balancing a bunch of factors that end up being meaningless. The lighter the front is, the better your transitions are, the heavier it is, you know, well, then it'll lift less, and the compensator further out is more lever arm to work the compensator further back. Like I said, it doesn't matter. We're going for cool. The other thing, of course, is that personally, I like the look of longer barreled guns. I adore my G34. It's really not all that different from the Glock 17, but I like shooting that gun. It's fun. So, long it is. The barrel, I'm probably just going to go with a bull barrel. I considered a hybrid or an island barrel, which is a bull barrel variant that has a big rib on the top. Those are kind of a pain to fit. I don't really think, I'm not quite sure the juice is all that worth the squeeze in terms of the extra cost. It might be a good gunsmith question there, probably, about hybrid barrels. But might go with a couple ports. That's definitely going to be a gunsmith experience thing. The other thing too is that I may just have him cut the slide so he can put ports in later. Try it without. If I don't like it, we can add some ports to get more control of muzzle lift.
Yeah, that's a good middle ground, I think.
Yeah, you got to lighten the slide anyway. If you lighten it up on the top, you have room for ports. But then, you know, if you can get away without the ports, the gun will be more enjoyable, more pleasant to shoot. Without ports. And ports, of course, get you earlier and therefore more gas that you're using to force the muzzle down. That also means your compensator gets less gas, which means it's less efficient. And then you can mess with this giant linked system and you can load more powder, but then, you know, you're getting more recoil force and it's more severe. So that's kind of what I'm thinking there. I am thinking steel grip, partially because this is Pittsburgh, it is a steel tan. Or whatever the hell they say around here.
That's probably about right.
I do like, you know, having the weight low and further back. I kind of like that. Also, you can get really aggressive steel grips. Phoenix Trinity makes a really cool one. The nice shape. It's got like a pre-pinned grip safety because nobody likes that stupid thing. And they've taken their time to really like make the grip a little more comfortable to hold. The other thing with the steel versus polymer grip, it's a lot easier to fit a polymer grip after the fact. Because if you're fitting it after the fact, you've already applied a finish to the frame. And so you probably are going to be more, it's going to be harder for you to cut on that to make fitting happen. So you're going to be cutting more on the grip module itself. And if you have nice soft plastic, that's a lot easier than dealing with metal.
It'll clog your files up, but you can actually, you know, cut into it at a reasonable pace.
Right. So if you have to fit one after the fact, the gunsmith is going to, you know, take less time and therefore charge you less money if it's a plastic one. And then props, if I do get a go plastic in the future, it'll be like one of the nice reduced and stippled ones that are rounded and less 2x4-ish. So there we go. The other big question left, and then of course there'll be a big magwell on the bottom, but that's something I'm a little less picky about. Just a nice big mag funnel, whatever.
Yeah.
It's got to be there. We've put enough weight in the damn thing between the long barrel, the bull barrel and the steel grip. It'll be heavy.
Doesn't matter exactly what it's made of or how big it is. But...
No. No, it's just, you're going to make a nice big one that'll be good enough because you just need that little edge when you're reloading. The last one is the sights, and the sights are a little tricky. There's no perfect option. On the one hand, you have the Seymour, the Railway. It's such a cool name, Railway.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the big one you always see, which has a really nice big window and a really nice clear dot. And what's cool is you can actually swap out the little dot projector module so you can get whatever size dot you want. And in terms of holding up to recoil, they do a great job. They're pretty big. There's lots of space in there for them to, you know, make it
beefy.
Stand up to beefy and stand up to that major power factor recoiling force. The sight adjustment is arcane and stupid. There's a hinge that the giant window is attached to the body by a hinge, and there's two screws crosswise that go into it that let you adjust windage and elevation, but they're codependent, and it's you know, they're incredibly touchy, and there's no, like, with a normal optic, you have clicks. This doesn't have clicks, and there's other retaining screws, and they can get stripped, and oh my, who designed this piece of shit? So I don't, those are super popular, though, because they've been around forever. People have gotten used to them, and they do have a really big window. which makes your job easier because it's easier to keep the dot in view if the view is huge. The microdots all have a smaller window. Some have a less small window than others. The Leupold Delta Point is a little on the smaller side. The Seymour RTS-2 and SIG Romeo 3 are a little on the bigger side. All of them, even the bigger ones, are they're still smaller than the Seymour Railway. But the RTS-2 or the Romeo 3 are probably what I'm leaning towards at this point. The one problem with the microdot is that they don't like recoil as much. And this isn't going to be frame-mounted, but even so, you're still, you know, kicking it around with big, high-power, high-velocity, draconic rounds. So, it's going to break. But, yeah, that's what you do. You want something that's reasonably reliable. I think they're all mostly reasonably reliable at this point, the latest build of whatever. So, bigger glass seems to be the way to go. And we'll see just kind of how that shakes out. That's going to be a little bit of an availability question, but that's where we're going right now. So Microdot, RTS-2, or the Romeo 3, they're both biggish. They're really similarly designed, actually. They use a similar, same screw pattern. And then because I'm not really doing porting, or certainly not extensive porting, the mount will probably not have a blast shield because I don't need it, because I can go further back with my little bitty Microdot. But I do kind of like the look of a two-sided mount, so two-sided shieldless mount is what I'm going to get.
All right.
Because, yeah, again, like a lot of this is looks cool, and then it's going to have a super sweet trigger because, I mean, it's a 1911 built by a guy who knows what he's doing. It better have, like, a sub-2-pound, you know, hair trigger of unsafeness. And
then plus two.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then a couple other, the other thing, of course, being a high capacity version of a 1911, all the small parts from 1911s apply. Some might do something goofy and go with like safeties with a little thumb shield or something so it doesn't rub on the slot. I don't know. Safeties that are cool looking.
Yeah. Well, you've got options for cool looking stuff. That's part of the reason you're buying it.
Right. Exactly.
Wide body.
Yeah. 1911 is that you get all of the options there. You can get actually the length. They make different length trigger shoes because of the way the 1911 trigger slides. So you can actually get exactly the right length for you.
Oh, there you go.
Pretty cool. So, yeah. So that's going to be the open gun. It's going to be lots and lots of fun. Oh, let's talk caliber for a second. No?
I don't think we've got the time for caliber discussion tonight.
That's all right. It's probably, you know, going to take entirely too long. And I'm going to bore the two people still listening to my...
Here, like the hour and 10-minute mark.
Yeah. Yeah, so caliber, nuts to that. I might write it up or just let you... I mean, I told you it's 38 Super Comp, so it's 38 Super Comp. Get over yourselves.
Maybe when we get both these guns done, we'll take them out to the range at the same time and do either a written review or we'll do a segment here.
Yeah, something.
Well, I think that more or less covers it up. The most exciting revelation there is that John actually enjoys... computational fluid dynamics, which I think is probably one of the first times that's been said by human, human lips.
Right? I actually it's fun. It's lots of fun. But that's what you come here for. You've blown another, hour and 10 or so with us.
Into overtime today.
Crazy people. Yeah. Hey, that's bonus podcast, dude. We're talking about overtime. But you've enjoyed some bonus podcast with us on the Crossbox Podcast, which is produced by my co-host Jay and me, John, and is brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manywords.press. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by the illustrious J-Man of ourmusicbox.com and is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution License. Keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press, where you can see some of the reviews of the topics of the things we've discussed tonight. Thanks, listeners. Have a great night.